Well, welcome to episode 502, and we are happy to have back with us Michael Orton, who was with us last year on opening day, and it's appropriate because this podcast is dropping on opening day here on Thursday, and Michael wrote a book about 50 opening days that we talked about in our episode last year, and so we thought it would be cool just to sort of go back and talk again. There are a lot of games going on today. A lot has happened in baseball the past year, so we're just going to do what we like to do best, and that's talk about baseball.
Hi, welcome to Almost Cooperstown.
I'm Mark.
And this is Gordon. And we love talking about baseball.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Mark. Really a pleasure to be here. It's the best day of the year. It's a rite of spring. And heck, we could talk 50 times about opening day because there's 50 different stories in the book. But it's always just a re-energizing time for all of us baseball fans.
I think it's just, I was talking about this the other day, that it's so interesting to me with opening day that there is so much more pomp and circumstance around the first game of baseball than the first game of the NBA season or the NFL season or the hockey season. And it's interesting because we play like double the number of games of all of them. And yet we put so much, there's so much about opening day that it feels less like, oh, I'm glad that Mets baseball is back, and it's, oh, I'm glad baseball is back. And I think that's just an interesting vibe that we get on a day like opening day.
It's just a day that's rich in tradition. You know, Cincinnati for years, as we know, was the city that got to host opening day, the first game of the year, no matter what, and it became a rich tradition there. You know, that changed over time, but it was a big day there. In Washington, D.C., the president of the United States was there to throw out the first pitch so often that it became a big event, a bad team, but big event. And after 9/11, the military flyovers became far more prevalent across the country. And it's a huge day. It's a page turn. It's a rite of spring. The players love it because they finally get to stop doing 6 weeks of baseball in Arizona and Florida and fake games and get to go play for real in front of a full house.
And it's kind of interesting because, yeah, everyone knows they're calling this, you know, opening day, official opening day, opening day traditional is what it's called, because we had the two games last week in Korea, and Gordon and I were talking before, you know, so the Padres and the Dodgers, they go and they split their two games in Korea and they fly back. And what I noticed over the weekend was there they are out there playing practice games again, exhibition games, after they played games that count. And I'll assume this has happened before because teams have traveled to Asia before and come back. But I hadn't really thought about it in that way.
Yeah, I think one of your emails said something about, well, we're going to drop this podcast on the real opening day. And I think that's the way a lot of fans look at it. Fine. I think baseball's got to do what it's got to do to explore new markets and play games that matter, just as the NFL has done in other countries, and whether it's Mexico or Japan or Korea, wherever they wind up playing games. But I think we tend to focus on this Thursday in half the cities and next Monday in the other half the cities.
Right. And so, you know, you have the Dodgers and the Padres. The Dodgers are obviously favorites to win the World Series. And you come back from Korea and you pitch two of your pitchers. So does that mean, and I haven't looked at the rotation for the Dodgers, does Glasnow start again on this week? Does Yamamoto get a start in the first game or two? Because it's not like he wouldn't be rested, or I assume they're going to give the other guys a chance and just make those guys wait a little bit longer.
Well, after the way Yamamoto pitched in Korea, I'm not sure how that's going to play out. But
right, it becomes a question of, do we rush him to get him back out there so we can get a good start under his belt, or do we give him some time so that's not fresh on everybody's mind?
Well, Mark, you said it right. You got to get these pitchers in their cadence, and what's the rhythm, and where are they? They've got their normal days of rest, and go out and pitch.
And that's kind of what happened to the Yankees a little bit, right? Because obviously Gerrit Cole comes up with an injury. And so they turn to Marcus Stroman, who, to much of the Yankee fans, and this is very local here, right, in the New York area, he declines to pitch opening day because it's not on his regular rotation.
Right.
As does Carlos Rodon. So the Yankees are going to run out Nestor Cortes, who said, sure, I'll pitch. You know, an opening day starter, I still think that's pretty cool. Thank you, Nestor, for the voice of sanity there in that case. But the fact that, you know, guys are just, they're not as focused on pitching opening day as we thought they were, in my mind. I don't know what you think about that, Michael, but to give up an opening day start?
It's so unfortunate that the game has changed in that way, and that the I think you just said it perfectly. That's how the game has changed, right? Who's in charge? A pitcher can decline opening day? Really? Yeah, can. He could decline.
Not only a pitcher can, he would. Like, that's the thing. It's not only does the pitcher have the ability to, it's not just something that teams can kind of hand down on high. Like, you're going to be starting opening day. The player has the freedom to just be like, I don't think so. But also that he would just not want to. Like, it's so surprising. But I think, I wonder how much kind of with players moving around teams so much more. Before, I think, starting opening day for a team that you've been on for the past X number of years, I think holds a lot more to you. Whereas for a lot of players, it's just sort of probably like for Marcus Stroman, he's been on a ton of different teams pitching. I wonder if pitching on opening day doesn't hold the same, value to him because it's just pitching the first game of the season to him more than anything, even though there's, and especially with all the injuries, it's not as guaranteed that the best pitcher on the team is pitching opening day anymore. Yeah. And so I wonder if that affects people's players' opinions of it, I should say.
It's disappointing that players are taking less value in the traditions that we hold sacred in the game and are more about, and I get it, the money in the game has gotten so big. And what's a priority in how I protect my body and how I manage to the stats that matter financially, et cetera. I get it, completely get it. But some of us just long for the days when, give me the ball. I want to go out and pitch 9 innings, coach. Let me go.
Seaver pitched 16 straight opening days. Carlton, 14. Jack, these are the most of all time. Jack Morris, 14. Randy Johnson and Walter Johnson both had 14 straight opening day starts. Yeah. And Randy Johnson, obviously not that long ago, that happened. And it's changed so quickly, that pride in saying, when I look back in the annals, right, and I look back in Baseball Reference and I can see all the opening day starters for every team, and I love doing that myself and all that. Yeah, it should say Randy Johnson or Walter Johnson. It shouldn't say, I remember when the Mets ran out Dylan G one year for opening day, and I'm like, God, that really shows you how bad the pitching was, right? They didn't have anybody else they wanted to put out there more. So it just doesn't have the meaning anymore to the players to do that. And I think that's just surprising because you would think pride would have some of these guys. How could Kershaw, who pitched 5 straight before this year, he would be pitching because I think he still values it the same way.
Absolutely. And this guy like Max Scherzer and others that really still do, but Verlander, et cetera. But it's it's premature to say it's a dying breed, but it's disappointing to see that there's a few that feel that way.
Well, I was going to say, I also think that if you think about it, for a lot of teams this year, there's a lot of specifically number ones on a lot of different staffs that aren't pitching at the start of this season. Garrett Cole is hurt. Jacob DeGrom is hurt. Kodai Senga is hurt. Like, you just start going down the list and there's guy after guy. The guys in Baltimore that are hurt. Like, there's so many teams' top flight starters that are hurt to start the season that you would have a lot less, notable guys starting on opening day just as a result of that. Like, there's just seems to be an epidemic of, Yuri Perez is, I think, a little injured and not going to necessarily start the season. But there's a lot of guys that would otherwise be starting opening day that I think aren't starting just because they're hurt, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. But that's just the way it fell this year. So 162 game season. They got to protect their bodies and stay healthy.
So do you guys, I asked this trivia question last week. So which current major league pitcher has the longest current streak for consecutive opening day starts?
Wow, that's a great one.
I feel like you just gave us the answer, but...
Oh, I did?
Well, I thought you just said that Kershaw started 5 in a row.
And somebody called me on that. It is not Kershaw.
It's not.
He's obviously not pitching anyway. This pitcher will make another consecutive opening day start on Thursday.
I'm stumped.
Okay, he'll be doing it at home against the Braves.
Wheeler?
Aaron Nola.
Wow.
Aaron Nola is the opening day pitcher for whatever reason that Philadelphia has sort of anointed as opening day pitcher. And once you get that mantle, I think Zach Wheeler would be fine, that Aaron Nola. Actually, I'm wrong. Zach Wheeler is going to snap. This is really strange. He's snapping Aaron Nola's streak of 6 in a row. And that blows me away a little bit. Not because I don't think Wheeler's a great pitcher and deserves it, but why would you do that to Aaron Nola?
Why this year? What's different this year?
No, he's not on his right schedule. So I don't know. So, you know, we're recording this a couple of days before opening day. And Michael, I wanted to ask you, and if you'd heard the news, and we probably should talk about this, about Shohei Ohtani. And the fact that he now has made his public statement regarding the hullabaloo around what happened between he and his not friend, interpreter, maybe kind of friend.
Yeah, I hadn't read Shohei's statement yet. I've been tracking the subject. I mean, we traded some emails about this, but baseball continues to play catch up with itself. The whole issue of gambling in baseball. Is it okay or is it not okay? You know, it was not okay when Pete Rose was doing it, but now it's okay to accept money from FanDuel and everybody else. And now we've got an interpreter. What did we think was going to happen? Is anybody minding the store? It's unfortunate. And there's going to be some consequences, I'm sure. But I didn't read what Shohei had to say. So tell me more.
What he said was only that he was not aware that this is what this guy said and represented was not at all what he told. He lied to Ohtani. He's been betrayed. What Ohtani said in general was what you would have hoped he would say. And now you have to hope that it's actually true.
Yeah. I mean, we've been through this in sports so many times. You hear these emphatic denials, whether it was steroids or gambling or whatever, from Lance Armstrong or baseball players or whomever. And eventually we find out maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't true. I would very much like to believe Shohei, and maybe he
really hope it's true. That's not true.
What's that?
I want him to be clean. It would sting to have a guy that this good to get brought down by something like this.
Absolutely. All I'm reminding us of is that we've been through this before with many other athletes who there's no way Lance Armstrong was bad, or there's no way that right. You find out, oh my gosh, you know, so believe me, I am right there with you. I think Shohei's a marvelous human being from everything I've read and heard over the years, and we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, and like I said, he did what you hoped he would do. And now we just have to hope that it actually is the case. And there's no reason why it couldn't be the case. I think so. People are trying to come up with these, conjure up these ideas of how he's tamping it down and how he's covering, and they'll come up, but they're investigating. I assume if they find something, they will, you know, it will come out publicly, and Ohtani already knows that, which is why I'm, I guess, relatively comfortable that it probably is something he didn't know about, and this will hopefully just blow over.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
So, we start the season, and Michael, when we talked to you last year, and we'll talk a little about the Nationals in a bit, about both the Nationals and nearby the Orioles. And obviously Peter Angelos just passed away the other day. And the Orioles finally have turned the corner from even where we talked about last year from where they were. And I know that you were sort of a forced Oriole fan, but where do you come down now? I know you're still a Nationals fan first and foremost, if not mistaken, but talk a little about the impact of what's going on in Baltimore and some of the things that happened with the family selling the team and all that, since you're local to that.
I think fans in the area knew that when Peter passed away, the team would be sold. And the reason it had to wait until that point in time was capital gains tax. He bought the team in 93 for $173 million, which at the time was the most amount of money ever paid for a baseball team or any sports team in North America. Here it is now worth $1.7 billion or $2 billion, whatever. But as it got closer, the family started they came up with a creative way to address that issue and actually consummated the sale with some wrinkles to it about the timing of Peter's passing, which of course sadly happened this weekend. But now it's a new day in terms of team ownership. But the team, as you mentioned, turned around a few years ago, and they started playing the numbers game and the new modern way of managing baseball, with stats guys and analytics that we didn't see 10 or 20 years ago. And it paid off. Mike Elias and others started this journey to make this team what it is now. And it's so wonderful for the city of Baltimore that has been through so much to have a team that's solid in the city for the new lease that'll go 15 years at least, maybe 30, The Ravens are much beloved and did very well this year. The city really needs these shots in the arm. So it's wonderful to see how well the Orioles are doing. Baseball fan, yes, no, you're right. I'm still a Nationals fan, but I am thrilled for Baltimore, what they're experiencing now. And the Nationals are where the Orioles were 3, 4, 5 years ago. A lot of young talent, a lot of quote-unquote inexpensive talent because they're young. They haven't turned the page of free agency yet. I had the pleasure of going to the spring breakout game between the Mets and the Nationals in Port St. Lucie last week.
I watched some of that too.
It was fantastic to see all this young talent that you know is going to be there in a couple of years. So yeah. Very optimistic the future, maybe not 2024, but the future is bright for the Nationals too.
I mean, as a National fan, last year was an interesting year because, you know, people were so down on the Nationals going into the season. So, I mean, they didn't end up with a winning record or even a .500 record, but they were a lot peskier of opponent and they played better than I think a lot of people expected them to last season. So is it interesting as a National fan this year sort of being like, well, where is the jump from that? Or are you kind of just, is it more about, let's see where these young guys are this year as they continue to come along and we kind of figure out who is part of our core in the future 3, 4 years from now?
So I have a three-part answer. First, any city that wins a World Series and then sees their top stars go away en masse for different reasons is disappointing. But you can't have a team with five. The Nationals won a World Series in 2019 with the oldest team in baseball. And then Max Scherzer's gone and Trey Turner's gone and Juan Soto's gone and so forth and so on. And fans are disappointed, angry, whatever. The team's not spending money, et cetera. If they'd re-signed those players at the price tags they're worth, they wouldn't have any money to pay anybody else.
Would have been worse.
Right, exactly. So wise moves in hindsight and look at the crop of young talent they got in exchange. So I've got no beef with that. I understand fans get angry, but fans want their owners to spend a lot of money. But then when they turn around and have creative new TV deals that require them to change over to apps to watch games or the ticket prices go up, then the fans get angry at that too. So we're just born to be angry and born to second guess things. I do like where the Nats are heading. It's going to get expensive in the future. Wouldn't it be neat to have Juan Soto re-sign with Washington next year, which long shot, I realize, but he's a free agent after this year. He loved Washington. He would like to come back together with all the players that San Diego sent to Washington to get him. Because Mackenzie Gore is going to start the home opener next Monday, and C.J. Abrams is out there at short, and James Wood had an amazing spring training, and we're just waiting for Robert Hassel III to step up. So what an irony that would be to have all of them on the same roster in 2025.
It'd be a masterclass in GMing if they pull it off. Like, oh yeah, we'll trade Juan Soto, then we'll just get him back 2 years later with all the prospects we got for him already.
For half a billion dollars, like, oh, but my God.
They've outsmarted everyone.
And you know, it's funny, people criticize the Learners and say they're unwilling to spend money. The Learners have spent money when it was the right money to spend. You go back to when they signed Jason Wirth years ago when the team was just rebuilding, they wanted to try to throw a message of credibility out there to the players to say, we're serious about paying, maybe even overpaying to get players. They obviously threw a lot of money at Max Scherzer to get him in the fold and so forth. There have been a few examples like that. They're not the freewheelers that you Mets fans enjoy, or the Padres enjoy. But then again, you can look at 2023 and say, was that really worth it? Who knows?
Well, that didn't exactly work out.
That's right.
they were smart enough not to re-sign Anthony Rendon and let him go. Some of the best deals you make are the ones you don't.
And after this year, at least Patrick Corbin's salary rolls off the books and the Nationals can.
That's got to be a relief.
Scherzer's Strasburg's is with us for a few more years, but
yeah.
That was a sad turn of events. But I don't think anybody regrets paying Straz that money, even though in the years of that money, he didn't earn them, but certainly he did in spades during the years prior.
The Nationals are sort of taking the same page that originally the Astros did, then the Orioles did. The Royals are kind of sort of trying to do that. But like you said, very right, Michael, is, you know, you have to be ready to put money into the team when the money's there. And it seems like Major League Baseball teams are starting to figure that out. And in terms of the Royals giving Bobby Witt the big deal, the Nationals will show up with money for the talented players once they start showing, but they had to sort of go down first. Whereas teams like the Mets, of which we're fans, they're trying to do this on the fly without finishing in last place, for a bunch of years. I think that's more difficult because you're not going to stockpile the talent. And building the minor league system, which the Mets are trying to tell us they're trying to be like the Dodgers. Well, that's frankly every team is trying to be like the Dodgers and have that kind of cycle of players that they can bring through. So I think that's sort of the way Major League Baseball in general has gone, not just the Nationals and the Orioles and the Astros and the Royals.
Well, and look, there's six or eight teams that just spend without thinking, and the Mets are among them. The rest are currently trying to be a little fiscally responsible, and you have this dark cloud of what's next in the regional cable sports TV business. As many markets are seeing their networks go away, MLB swooping in and trying to make them whole. They're not certain what that revenue stream is going to look like in the future, and it does make it a little difficult to plan salaries when you're not sure when what used to be one of your primary revenue streams, maybe not in the future, is big, but still it's a changing landscape, and they got to adjust to that.
Yes, yeah. As licensing revenue becomes more significant to teams than it's been in the past, that's starting to, I want to say, it's filling up some of the shortfall there, yeah. Right? So I don't think that was predicted, 5 or 6 years ago, but MLB licensing in general has done a very good job of figuring out, hey, we've got some valuable properties here. Let's make sure everybody cashes in and we can all make more money doing that, which helps all the teams, not just the big market teams.
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I also mentioned something to Gordon before the podcast started, Michael, and this is a groaner for Mets fans. So in this millennium, right, in this century, wow, four teams have won World Series championships for the National League East. The Mets are not one of them.
Who would have thought that? The right? Marlins would have more World Series titles than the Mets in that period of time.
So, and you're right that, spending money, or when the Mets had the Wilpons running the team, not spending money, or at least not spending it wisely, would probably be even a better way to do it, certainly is not the answer. And I think there's a bunch of teams, including the Padres, that will go, yeah, you take your shots sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't work out.
That's right.
So now the Nats are in Cincinnati playing what, like you mentioned, would have been the first game years ago. Mm-hmm. I think it was Joe Posnanski who was writing recently just saying, when did that change? Like Cincinnati wasn't the first game and nobody cared anymore.
I don't remember exactly, but I do know that when we have these strike delayed seasons like we had in 2022, you suddenly have this whole new array of opening. What was supposed to be opening day is now not going to be opening day, and now it's going to be somewhere else. So that may have played into it, but I don't remember when that changed or why it changed. But I'm sure the people of Cincinnati are disappointed. But yeah, baseball has wisely moved toward trying to synchronize schedules. They started this a few years ago, as you guys know, the last day of the season,
right?
Having every single game begin at 3 o'clock Eastern time to let the excitement of the final day of the season play out in real time everywhere and not have guys sit in the locker room waiting 3 hours to see, am I in the playoffs or not? I think they moved toward that with opening day. And I think you made the point a year ago, this conversation about the first time in a long time that back since the 60s when everybody was playing at the same time. And that added another specialness to opening day that just, it resonates for the fans.
And they tried, it looks like by the schedule, to keep the warm weather teams at home or the dome teams hosting. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't do it universally because there are too many, and Gordon and I were talking about this, but there are too many extenuating factors like road trips. And yeah, if you're playing east versus west, you're only getting four games a year against those teams. So you only have one series. Boston is at Seattle. And that's a very weird place for the Red Sox to yeah, open, considering that's the only time they're going to see the Mariners all season.
And they also keep Friday open on everyone's schedule so that if the weather's iffy on Thursday anywhere, they will not hesitate to postpone to the next day because they want this first impression of the team to be as good as it can be, a great experience for the fans.
And there's a very good chance the Mets are going to be taking that on Thursday because it is forecasted to rain very heavily here in New York. So we might be looking at a Friday opening day.
I got to tell you, my streak of 50 consecutive opening days, I endured some pretty miserable weather in Chicago, Baltimore, and Washington. Oh, my gosh.
It's early this year. It's March. It could be snowing in some places if they're unlucky.
I was at Harry Carey's first game at Wrigley Field as the announcer for the Cubs in 1982. It was 34 degrees, and the fans were taking snowballs and throwing them on the field. It was crazy.
Yeah, I know the Tigers have been snowed out on opening day in the past. So that's something that nobody really wants to see. But I've been at some pretty cold opening days at the old Shea Stadium. I think I mentioned one in 1985 when Gary Carter sent us all home gratefully in his first game in the 10th inning with a game-winning home run. And mainly because we were so darn cold, we just wanted to go home.
We didn't even want to be there.
Yes, indeed.
Please make it stop. Please make it stop. I want to turn the page just a little bit, Michael, because we talked about something in our podcast last year, and we exchanged some emails back and forth. And one of the things that you mentioned was the ERAs committee is meeting this year. I think it's Classic Baseball ERA Committee is this year, 2024, which goes before 1980, players before 1980. And I think we talked about in our podcast last year the fact that we all, three of us, feel that Curt Flood is a guy who probably should, you know, be in the Hall of Fame already, or should be in the Hall of Fame, or not probably. And Dick Allen is another guy that I think we all feel that way. And so we're talking about what if those two guys were to go in together and sad to say that, you know, they're not going to be able to be there to enjoy that.
It would be remarkable because when, you know, I mentioned earlier in this conversation today that baseball is constantly playing catch up, and that's, it would be nice if things were better in the first place, but at least you acknowledge that something went wrong and you've got to fix it going forward. So when it comes to Black players in the Hall of Fame, there were none until there was about 10 that came in the 70s and 80s. And then Ted Williams started advocating, you know, we need to see more Negro League players in the Hall of Fame. And they started to trickle in. And then Bud Selig, when he was commissioner, commissioned a large study by the team in Cooperstown to say, give us a report on Black baseball from the late 19th century all the way up to 1950 with the end of the Negro Leagues. And that resulted in this huge infusion of Negro League players into the Hall of Fame in 2006, I think it was, when 17, 18 players came in. So that catch-up continues. The ERAs Committee or Veterans Committee that had different names and different iterations over the years are just another example of that. How do we right the wrong? How do we fix the guy that didn't get in that should have gotten in, whether it's Mike Mussina or Harold Baines or whomever, these kind of guys come in later. So here we have that opportunity with Curt Flood. Now, the rules of one of the committees was, I think the breakpoint was 1970 in a previous iteration of this. And it would be tough to look at a guy like Curt Flood, whose big contributions as a player, certainly not Hall of Fame worthy statistics, but he was perhaps the best center fielder defensively of the 1960s, and was on All-Star and played in three World Series, had some cred in the 60s, but not enough to get in the Hall of Fame. In the 70s, of course, what he did off the field, selflessly sitting out a season, giving Marvin Miller at least the weather balloon he needed to see how much interest is there in this idea called free agency that we might be able to explore in baseball. Because as we know, prior to Curt Flood, every player was an indentured servant, property of the owner. And Curt Flood went for it. I thought it was interesting that when Gerrit Cole, and I put this in the book, was introduced by the Yankees, it was about a month after Marvin Miller had gone into the Hall of Fame. And Marvin Miller, as we know, resisted that for years. And posthumously, his family said, he doesn't want to be in the Hall of Fame, but they elected him anyway. And Marvin Miller belongs in the Hall of Fame. He changed the game. He changed professional sports, as we all know. But there are many people, myself included, who feel that Marvin being there is incomplete without Curt Flood by his side, because Marvin would not have been able to accomplish what he had accomplished if it hadn't been for guys like Curt Flood and then later Dave McNally, another hero who just selflessly decided to give up a bunch of money that could have accepted to become a pawn in that game that Marvin Miller ultimately prevailed in. So Curt Flood belongs there. Now, Dick Allen, the irony that exists there is that it was a trade to Philadelphia.
Right.
That Curt Flood said, I don't want to go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the northernmost southern city in America. And what we saw in the movie 42, if you know what Jackie Robinson went through in Philadelphia, it was real. There was a lot of racial tension in Philadelphia, as far north as it is. And players like Jackie Robinson and later Dick Allen felt it firsthand. And Kurt Flood said, I'm not going there to put up with that. I want to play somewhere else. And that's what set off the whole chain of events. So Dick Allen, of course, wound up in Chicago playing for the White Sox and had a great career and belongs in the Hall of Fame on his own merits as a player. But wouldn't it be amazing if the two of them went in together? It would be yet another catch-up reminder to baseball that there were some racial problems in the past in the post-Jackie Robinson era that we didn't address and that we should address and we should talk about and understand.
And I think that's a really good point, because I feel like so often we as baseball fans sort of go, and Jackie Robinson integrated into baseball and everything was okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's not how it worked. It wasn't like Jackie Robinson came in and yeah, there were some problems with that. Well, you know, he had some struggles, but then everybody was just totally cool after that. We had no issues. And that ignores so many key moments, you know, that happened throughout baseball. You know, Hank Aaron was definitely affected by some of that lingering racism and resentment when he was chasing Babe Ruth's home run record. That definitely factored into how some people were treating him. So I think that us ignoring that is definitely something that baseball kind of wants to shove under the rug, or just they like being able to conveniently not deal with it as much as they can.
Well, it's interesting. There were certain chapters in my book where I woke up in the morning and I said, okay, it's 1987. What am I going to write about this year? I don't remember opening day 1987. So I did a little research and I come to realize that, okay, that day they're honoring. I read Tim Kirkson was writing for the Baltimore Sun at the time. And Timmy had a little sentence in that day's paper about today they're going to honor the 40th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's debut with the number 42 emblazoned on second base. La-di-da. That was it. Okay. It was a start. And it turned out to be a disaster, because now there's a little bit of national media attention on the fact that it's Jackie Robinson's 40th anniversary of his debut, or the season is. And that night on Nightline, Ted Koppel had one of Jackie Robinson's former roommates from the 1940s, a guy named Al Campanis, who was a vice president with the Dodgers at the time. And Campanis, those of us who are old enough to remember the interview, it was a complete embarrassment to baseball. Al Campanis got fired the next day. He was grilled by Koppel politely at first, but it got tense as the interview went on. It's out there on YouTube. You can find it. But he said that, he was asked why there weren't more black managers or general managers in baseball. And he said, well, they lack the necessities to be general managers and managers. And Koppel was dumbfounded and he pressed him on a little bit harder. And Campanis defended himself by saying, well, they also lack the buoyancy to be good swimmers. And it was just, it was beyond cringeworthy. It was awful. So wow. This is 1987. And there had been discussion in baseball at the time. I believe Ueberroth was the commissioner at the time, but you know, we ought to do something big and we ought to stop the game and we ought to have some kind of acknowledgement. And the response was, you can't stop a game in the middle of a game. Well, you couldn't stop a game in the middle of a game in 1987 until Cal Ripken did it in 1996. Or, he broke Lou Gehrig's record. Now it was okay. So thankfully, again, baseball playing catch up with itself. 1997, they stop a game at Shea Stadium, game between the Mets and the Dodgers. Bud Selig, Bill Clinton, and Jackie's widow go out to pitcher's mound, and Bud Selig announces that number 42 is going to be retired in perpetuity throughout all of baseball. Perfect, perfect execution of the 50th anniversary of Jackie. So again, botched it in 87, fixed it in 97. I had the privilege of sharing that story in the book around Mariano Rivera, himself an immigrant, a trailblazer in his own right. 2002, he's on the opening day roster for the Yankees, of course, after blowing game seven in the desert, no one, but he honored Jackie Robinson so much and forged a great relationship with Rachel Robinson. And Rachel really appreciated the fact that Mariano was the last one to wear number 42. So the whole story comes full circle and really kind of gets better as the years go on.
And the, you know, I think Marvin Miller, back to him, just, were he have been around when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, I think he might have turned down the induction, unless he went in with Dick Allen and or Kurt Flood.
Probably Kurt Flood,
given the circumstances. That's the kind of person Marvin Miller was.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And if you go out on YouTube, you can find many a Marvin Miller interview in which he just praises Kurt Flood as a union organizer's dream. He is a man of great principle. You know, look, let's be honest. Voting people into the Hall of Fame for decades was a popularity contest. The voters were puppets of the owners. They were out there to tell a good story. They were to ignore the bad stuff. And if a player ruffled your feathers, you ignored him. And frankly, if he was a black player and ruffled your feathers, a guy making $90,000 a year as a baseball player, how dare he want more, especially a black one, would be the mindset of the writers of that day. And today that's preposterous, but that's the kind of stuff Dick Allen and Curt Flood had to put up with.
And that really makes what they did, and really in a lot of ways, the sacrifices that Curt Allen made, Curt Flood made.
Yep.
By taking on essentially that fight, really speaks to, and I think that was it, like the strength of character for him to say, look, what's important here isn't me, it's what I'm representing and what my fight is going to do for everybody that comes after me. And there's not a lot of people that can have the character that are willing to lay, you know, their own situation down to better peoples in the future,
especially when he had so little support from his contemporaries. Mm-hmm. You know, the Players Association voted to pay Curt Flood's legal bills on this challenge. But that was it. When he was sitting in a courtroom in New York and the Cardinals were in town to play the Mets, do you think any of his Cardinals teammates came out to support him? Not one. Bob Gibson even said, was I behind Curt Flood? You better believe it. About 10 feet behind Curt Flood, because if there's any fallout, I didn't want it to hit me. At least he was honest about it. But you're right. The courage of a guy like Curt to step up and do what he did with no support from his contemporaries is very hard. Can't imagine that today.
There's not many guys that would be able to take, you know, stand up like that and knowing what it's going to do to you and really be out on an island by yourself.
Well, and you guys know this better than anybody, but the criteria for getting into the Hall of Fame, now I'm not saying this has been respected since the day it was written, but there's 6 points in there. Only three of them have to do with your on-field performance. The others are integrity, sportsmanship, and character. Integrity, sportsmanship, and character are three of the six criteria the voters are supposed to take into account.
Some of the most immeasurable things in the human condition that possibly exist.
Unless we want to use them to keep Pete Rose and steroid guys out, then all of a sudden it's character and integrity. But
exactly.
I'll put Curt Flood on the Mount Rushmore of character. Yeah. And try and do what's right for the game.
We're just a couple of weeks from the 50th anniversary of a seminal baseball event on April 8th. And we had Pat Ahern on our podcast. I don't know if you heard that one, Michael. He was a former major league pitcher briefly for the Detroit Tigers. And somehow we got on the subject of Tom House, because he knows Tom and he's worked with him. And I quipped that Tom House caught Hank Aaron's 715th home run in the bullpen. And yep. So he told me all about that. He says he got the ball because he was a rookie. And then all he could think about was going out after he got running out and giving Hank the ball, you know, to make sure that, you can see him presenting him the ball. But you talk about a guy that faced racism and handled with poise and class just because he was the greatest home run hitter ever and a great baseball player. I think we sometimes forget how impactful that whole scenario was and how he kind of brought the nation through a very difficult time with the way that he handled himself.
And, you know, if you haven't listened to it, if your listeners haven't listened to it, go out on YouTube and find Vin Scully's call of that moment in baseball history. Because, of course, the Braves happened to be playing the Dodgers, so Vin was doing the radio for the Dodgers broadcast, and you see that overlaid with the actual video of that night. And Vin Scully made really clear that to see what is happening in the Deep South when a black man has broken the record of one of the great white icons of all time was a truly moving and stirring way to present that incredible moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't want to put you on the spot, Michael, but you also have a personal interest in this subject because of your own family. I don't know if you'd be willing to talk about that a little bit and how it impacts your life and what you're doing, because I think it's probably why you have such passion for it.
It does. Passion we all should have for it, but I have a different lens through which to see it because my wife and I, after three white birth children, adopted three black children. And so you go through life experiencing all kinds of things that most people don't experience or see things that other people don't see about the way your children are treated or the things people will say to you before they realize you have Black children. Then all of a sudden their choice of words changed. It's uncomfortable, and you use it as an opportunity to help one by one have conversations with people and change the world. My son, Greg, is number four son. He's our oldest adopted child. He is a diehard Oriole fan. And we've had plenty of encounters at the ballpark with players and fans over the years where I tell the story in the book about the night of Cal Ripken's last game. And the closest we could get to the field was about the 10th row for the postgame ceremony, which was good enough. You get to see all the hoopla, whatever. So then I tell Greg, I said, Greg, take your ticket with you. He's got a ticket from the game. In fact, I actually have it here. I'll show you in a second. And go stand next to that man in the brown coat in the front row. Now, the man in the brown coat in the front row was a man I did not know. It was Ron Shapiro. Now, I know who he was, but Ron Shapiro is the agent for Eddie Murray and Cal Ripken and Dante Bichette, by the way, Bo Bichette's dad, who it was his last game in the majors too that night. And I said, just stand there and see what happens. So Greg goes down there and he nuzzles up next to Ron Shapiro. And Ron immediately turns around to look at the section behind him, looking for, I'm sure, a Black face who must be this kid's dad. Finding none, he's a little perplexed and lets this kid stand there. Well, the kid stands there, my son. And of course, Eddie Murray comes over to see his agent, and Eddie signed nothing. Cal signed everything, but Eddie didn't sign a whole lot of things. Greg has the only ticket's got to be signed by both Cal Ripken and Eddie Murray and Dustin Bichette from that night.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yes. So, and that's exactly how I got it. So it's a lot of fun stories like that over the years. And you just look, Greg has been wrestled to the ground by cops on cases of mistaken identity for crimes he didn't commit because he looked like he fit the part. And that's a horrible story that so many young Black men can tell. And as a parent of a young person who's experienced that, it really brings the stories of people like Dick Allen and Kurt Flood of a different era to life in a different way. And you see what's going on in our country in the last 5 years, you realize we're not over it yet. We weren't over it in 87. Yes, we put some salve on the wound in 97, and we still have a ways to go in baseball and in life.
We do have a ways to go, and it reminded me of something that I'm reading about major league teams, and that they finally have on almost every team has on staff a Spanish translator or somebody who's there to help facilitate the relationship between the players and the club, particularly if the manager or whatnot is not a native Spanish speaker. A lot of them are now, and a lot of managers at least are becoming aware of the fact that they should learn this, and this is a very important thing to communicate. But it took years and years and years, and I don't know how else you can term it as prejudice or racist to not allow guys on the team to have a conduit to be able to talk to their manager directly because they can't speak the language.
Well, and it goes beyond translators too. It's just team chemistry. I think one of the great things of the Washington Nationals in 2019 was the team chemistry started with Davey Martinez, who grew up in New York. First language is English. They don't let the last name fool you. He speaks Spanish, of course, but he has Juan Soto and Victor Robles, who are young, talented players, but they were the only Spanish speakers on the team, and they were kids. They were needed to, so they get out in the offseason and they acquire Anibal Sanchez. Okay, and then Anibal Sanchez needs his catcher, and they get Kirk Suzuki. Still not quite enough. Chemistry's not right. The Nationals start off 19-31, as we know, but then they picked up Gerardo Parra, one more Spanish speaker in the dugout. And suddenly the locker room and dugout chemistry changed because, to your point, you have people that you can look up to, you can interact with, you can bond with, you maybe have similar musical interests or whatever it may be, and the team chemistry improves. It's just, and it's corporate America that's embracing DE&I. They're not doing it because it's woke or whatever people say now, or it's politically correct. It's good business. Mm-hmm. And locker room chemistry is good for the game. And teams that embrace it are winning.
And I think you bring up a really good point bringing in those players, because it's one thing when you have older baseball players on the team to help mentor these young guys on what it is to be a good baseball player. Mm-hmm. But there's a difference when you have these players that are in a different country, that are in it, that they need, they're learning from another Latin player that's teaching them how to be a young Latin player in America. Because that's very different than learning to be a young baseball player in America. There's going to be challenges that those guys face, is that a kid that's from, you know, somewhere in Baltimore that grew up there isn't going to have, because he's not going to go through the same thing. So when you bring in those other guys around them to help them, they're able to feel more comfortable and part of the team rather than just sort of constantly feeling like they're flying by the seat of their pants. I can imagine that probably helped them relax a ton throughout the course of that season.
I absolutely agree. You've got to have the right people to give you comfort and feel less pressure. Where do I go for stress reliefs? Does all add up?
And I think Gerardo Parra, and that's a great story on him. I think he, I don't know if he's managing or coaching someplace, but it would follow based upon what you say, bringing him in for chemistry and performance, obviously. But I thought that's sort of one of those unheralded things you don't really think about, that it changes the mojo, or I could say the chemistry of the team, because you've got a communication that was holding you back. And boy, how important is that? And it wasn't a $50 million player that did it.
He's the first base coach of the Washington Nationals this season.
I knew he was into coaching, and I think I knew you'd know that too. I didn't worry about that, to be honest. Michael, your book, Opening Day 50 for 50, and we enjoyed that. We talked about it last year. Are you working on another book? Are there other things in the pipeline? Writing a book, I know something I think about, is a monumental task. And so maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
It is, and I don't have one. It's funny, I went to the 96th birthday party recently of my former boss, Charlie Brotman, who was the subject of chapter 1983 of the book. And there was only a handful of us there, but Christine Brennan, great sports writer, great book author in her own right, and her publicist as a woman named Meredith Geisler, who interned with me, if you can believe that, back in 1983. She said to me, "Do you have another book in you?" And that's exactly the right question to ask. And I just said, right now, I don't. I'm having way too much fun celebrating this one. The things that I've gotten to do in the last 2 years add up to comparable to what I got to do in the 50 years prior. It's really been a blast. But I just don't know what I do. And when I do, I'll sit down and bang one out. But it's not an easy task. It's a big one. And not much reward in it, as any baseball writer, baseball author will tell you. Unless your name is Jane Levy or Tom Boswell, I don't think you make a whole lot of money selling books, baseball books, but we'll see. Right now, the answer is no.
Well, thanks, Michael. And you know, the book Opening Day 50 for 50, you know, get it if you want to read it. It's sort of timeless, even though it talks about a specific, you know, period of years. You really get a sense of baseball history. Gordon and I both recommend it. I enjoy talking with you around Opening Day. And Gordon, I don't know about you, but I could see us doing this sort of annually.
I kind of like it being a yearly thing. It's just all, it's the right way to kick off the best part of this year.
That'd be wonderful. You know, I just now uploaded this week the audio files of each of the chapters of the book, so that if you don't want to buy the book, you just want to listen to a chapter, they're all on openingday5050.com. Just go to the chapters and pick a year. And I want to hear the story of Carl Yastrzemski. You go to 1975 and there it is. So help yourself for free if you want to just listen to a chapter at a time.
You know, writers are going to say, Mike, you can't make money if you're giving away the stuff for free. But it's nice for you to come on our podcast and offer that to our listeners. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. And
yes, thank you.
Season, we'll be thinking about you in Opening Day and throughout the season.
Same. Take care, guys.
Thank you for listening. You can follow us on your favorite podcast platform, or follow us on YouTube, where we have video form of these podcasts.
Or you can also follow us on social media, on Insta, on Twitter, or on Facebook at Almost Coop. Thanks for listening.